Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Art of Craftsmanship podcast. My name is Dustin O'Hara, and I'm here with my brother and co-host, Evan.
Hey, hello.
And tonight we are joined by Yates Spencer from Athena Skillets. Yates, welcome.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, Devin, what do you got for us today?
All right, this is a long one, so hold on to your butts. I'm going to try to do it all in one go.
All right.
We are, after all, citizens of the world, a world filled with bacteria, some friendly, some not so friendly. Do we really want to travel in hermetically sealed Pope mobiles through the rural provinces of France, Mexico, or the Far East, eating only in Hard Rock cafes or McDonald's? Or do we want to eat without fear, tearing into the local stew, the humble mystery meat, the sincerely offered gift of a lightly grilled fish head? I know what I want. I want it all. I want to try everything once. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Senor Tamale, stand owner, sushi chef Sam, Monsieur Buckethead. What's that feathered game bird hanging on the porch, getting riper by the day, the body nearly ready to drop off? I want some. Cooking is a craft, I like to think, and a good cook is a craftsman, not an artist. There's nothing wrong with that. The great cathedrals of Europe were built by craftsmen, though not designed by them. Practicing your craft in expert fashion is noble, honorable, and satisfying. I'll generally take a stand-up mercenary who takes pride in his professionalism over an artist any day. End scene.
Nice. That's that is very poetic, very that's great. I like
very long and poetic.
Yeah.
Any guess, yeah. Dustin or Yates, on what that's? It's from a book by a famous personality.
I have no idea.
Is it like Anthony Bourdain?
It is like Anthony Bourdain.
It's like...
It is. It's like because it is.
Hey, all right, nice. As you were like, you're going through, it was kind of remind me of like a travel food show type idea. You know, someone who's willing to go out and go places and try things and be part of that culture and learn and seek knowledge and seek enjoyment from the craftspeople of those different places. So,
yeah, it's from his the book that made him like kind of began him as a star. It's called Kitchen Confidential. Really good book, really good read. And then after that, that's when he started a TV show and you know, did all the stuff he's done. But so the beginning, just a general feeling, which I liked and I do like about that exploring food and being adventurous. But I mean, I also, like when I went on my honeymoon to Europe, We definitely did stop at McDonald's. Definitely not all the time, but there were times when we were so tired and like there was nothing open, or we didn't feel like having a 3-hour meal. You know, we were just like, let's sit here and have a burger in London or something. But I like that, and then I also like. Well, it depends, right? The whole, we constantly go over it about what's a craftsman, what's an artist, mm-hmm. but being called either or, sometimes it's just, it's almost equal to me. Or, you know, you could kind of, I think a craftsman's always honorable and you can give an artist crap. Maybe it's not less honorable, but there's more room for making fun of them.
I like that. I agree. I mean, I think the boundaries of what an artist is are maybe wider, or maybe are less defined. So you know, when someone says they're an artist, it can kind of encompass a lot of things. And so, but a craftsman usually has a specialty in a certain craft, right? So you're like, okay, I'm a craftsman in this, or like I focus on this. And I think we understand that craftsmanship is something that, you know, takes time and some focus and some, you know, I guess just something a little bit more, or I guess maybe something more definable than artist. Yeah. That's a little bit less definable. So it's yeah. Go ahead.
I think you're right. And he seems to be making some sort of distinction in his mind, or that seems clear in his mind, between a craftsman and an artist. But I mean, you know, traditionally, artists were people who had really developed a craft. They really learned a craft. And then they become an artist because they found a way to express themselves through it, rather than just cooking the same meals that, you know, they were always taught and was part of their culture and everything. They then would learn to come up with something new and express something through that, through this craft that they had learned. And I think that's a little bit lost in this distinction that he's making.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right, because it's understanding the craft so well that then you can elaborate on it or abstract on it, and then that, and you know, do something new, pull something new from it,
right,
which is then maybe where it turns to the art.
Yeah,
I think you're right. Yeah, I think. And that's, again, that's always one of those things, and it's obviously defined in the name of our channel and the podcast, The Art of Craftsmanship, is like, right, what is that? You know, like there's always something there. That's something that I've always felt was really important, all the way back to when I was stretching canvases in art school and how I was just enjoying the pure stretched canvas with the gesso on it, just clinging everything done really well and really tight. I was having almost just as much enjoyment of that as I was creating a painting then on that canvas.
Sure.
So I, like, at that point I knew there was something really important about the making and the doing and that object that was important.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. I remember one time one of your, I don't know if it was a sculpture project, us, when you were in college, and we stretched canvas between branches in a tree.
Yep.
So it was like this giant, it was like many sails, or I forget exactly what it was, but that was one of those things. It's you feel like you're doing a craft almost, or like we said, it's, you could say either one, but it's definitely at the end of it, the combined thing is a piece of art.
Right. Yeah. It's like the physicality of wrapping and this like tightening and adjusting, that feels like it's a craft, like it's something where it takes some skill and some ability, and then the final piece, the concept of it, and then the interaction between the viewer and the piece is then when the art happens, I believe. So
right,
I don't know.
Now, before we give Yates's intro, just a sneak peek, he does all types of great cookware. Now, do you feel the whole time, put you on the spot, do you feel as an artist doing it, or do you feel as a craftsman when you are doing 10 handles in a row? Maybe as separate pieces, it's not a thing of finished art. Maybe you're just more of a craftsman as you're doing it on the assembly line, and then at the end, you kind of can stand back and say, this is a piece of art. Which way do you see it?
Well, it's... For me, you know, I started doing this when I was 12 years old, and like in the shop that I was working, there was this real effort to balance the craft work and the artwork. And there was this understanding that they fed each other. So I'm always kind of feel like I'm doing both, regardless of what the product, the end product of the specific thing I'm making. It's always, it's all the same big ball of wax, I guess, in my mind. So I don't really know that I have the feeling that, you know, making skillets is not art, or that making skillets is just purely craft, because I mean, it's already happened. Like I've been, you know, making the same handle that I've made 50 times before or more and come up with a new idea. It's just, it's all part, it's all part of, you know, being in it to me, I guess, if that makes sense.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense, because I mean, I can completely relate as an artist and as a craftsman that it's about being in that moment in the creation of it, and all the parts of that are all part of, it's all craft and art mixed together.
Right.
Like when I'm picking colors on my, you know, palette to mix together, and I'm mixing them and I'm doing it really smooth and consistent and scraping and flipping and getting those colors mixed, that's in that moment, that might not be art, but that's all part of it. It's all wrapped up. That,
exactly.
Like, that's more of a craft of like, how do I use my hand to do this thing to mix these colors? And then I take that color and then put it on the palette.
Right.
So that's all part of that being in the moment.
Right.
That's a great example. All right. Well, on that note, I do want to introduce Yates. So today we have Yates Spencer from Athena Skillets with us. He's at Athena_Skillets on Instagram. Yates is a blacksmith, for a long time blacksmith turned more culinary, cookware tool maker, and more recently in your life. And then you have a family run business with your sons, which touches our souls, 'cause we have that kind of background as well with our dad.
Right.
And to be honest, I don't know a ton about you. You reached out to me recently and we kind of had this quick conversation back and forth, and you hit me like right at the perfect time when I was like, I need someone for the podcast this week. Oh. And I started talking to you and I was like, perfect timing. Yates, you want to join us? And you were like, that's perfect. So welcome to the Art of Craftsmanship podcast. And,
thanks for having me.
And we're excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of read up on you briefly from what I could find online, and one of the things that I'm really interested in is about hearing kind of your story. Like you alluded to it, where you started learning blacksmithing when you were 12. So can you like take us back then? And for a 12-year-old, I mean, when I was 12, I knew I loved art, but you know, I had no real direction other than like drawing comics and hanging out in school with my friends, you know. So
right.
So what were you doing then? Like, what really got you into blacksmithing, and how'd that go?
It started when my parents had a railing made for our house, and the local blacksmith, who was a good family friend, came and installed it, and he had to take certain elements out into the yard and get them hot with a torch and bend them, and I was just fascinated. I just, like, I could not get my eyes off of it. And he saw that, and he offered to show me some things. So not long after that, I started going into his studio and doing some basic things, and we hit it off, and it all kind of worked. He was only 10 years older than me, but he was also somebody who had started very young and was very very passionate about it, and had already really learned a lot. He was very much into sculpture, and mostly metal, but other forms of sculpture as well. So there was definitely this balance all of the time between, you know, doing this craft work, which, you know, that's what pays the bills, doing sculpture, which, you know, when you sell it, great, but it's not really what it's about. So I continued to apprentice with him through my teenage years. And, you know, at times I was really in there a lot. Other times, you know, I was playing sports or whatever, you know, had a girlfriend or whatever, and not doing as much of that. But I really did stick with it. And I was
very... So what were you... What were you guys making? Sorry, like, what were you making at the time there? I know you said some sculpture and some metalwork. Was that like architectural stuff, like railings and things? Is that more that kind of production work as well as some of the artistic
stuff?
Both.
We were doing all of that. I've kind of always kept all those things going.
Okay.
It's good to have. You always have something to do, you know. Like you don't have to worry about right. Like when you're doing commission work all the time. You know, you get sucked into a commission that can last weeks or months or something, and if there's a snag in any way, and you're all of a sudden you can't do anything, like you could go make a sculpture or do some production work or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, the production stuff was always. Everything I've been involved in is very small scale. So it's dealing with galleries and, you know, a handful of galleries usually. So it's not like you're, you know, somebody's waiting on your truckload of product or something like that, you know. So it was was very, very, very flexible, the production work, always, and for me. Nice. Until the skillet thing has become more of a focus for me recently. But the production work has never really been the total focus in this way.
Gotcha. So that's kind of taking you up through high school. After high school, what did you do? Did you go right into...
Right. I mean, I would like to say something else about that. I was very fortunate in that the guy who taught me... really spent a lot of one-on-one time with me, and that's how you learn the craft of blacksmithing. It's extraordinarily difficult to learn in a classroom setting or by yourself. People do it. I mean, they're you know, it happens, but it really, there's a reason that, you know, traditionally you serve as an apprentice. That's how you learn it, and it's because you need that one-on-one instruction, particularly with the ergonomics of how to use your body. I was very fortunate that I was really drilled in all of that stuff, and I had a set of eyeballs on me to, like, you know, say, no, man, you're, you know, swing the hammer like this, or, you know, when you're grinding, move from your ankles, or all those kinds of things. And it really established for me all sorts of patterns, not just physically, but also just how, you know, I thought about things, approached things that I just don't think would have happened had I not had that one-on-one instruction at such an early age. Lee Souter was the name of the man who I apprenticed under, and it really benefited me a lot, and I would like to mention that. So,
what year was that when you were...
Like 82 or 83 is when it started.
3 years.
Right. And then, so gotcha. I worked through high school. After high school, I took a year and spent most of it just blacksmithing. And then I went to college, and I really wanted to study sculpture, but it just seemed like literally the metal sculpture program, literally they had a torch. You know, and I was like, well, I can go home and have this whole shop and do all this stuff I've been doing for years. Like, why would I do that here? And so I really didn't. I did take several drawing classes, which was great. But I ended up studying geology, which actually, in a roundabout way, ended up greatly influencing my artwork. I really got into studying... a lot of structural geology, which in structural geology, they have this way of describing the way that shapes deform. Basically that the whole idea is you just start with a sphere, and any event can be described by how does the sphere change. And so I studied that, and it fascinated me because I just, you know, I'd been watching metal change for so many years, changed in shape. And, I ended up just kind of applying that to hot metal and basically creating shapes and then and watching how they deform and trying to really exploit the plasticity of metal. And that knowledge that I gained through geology really has served me well in understanding how the metal is changing shape. So,
right. So were you getting into, like, did you get into more like metallurgy as well, or is just more the kind of the concept of how those things change?
Right. I mean, you have to get into metallurgy to a certain extent, but I cannot say that I have ever got really thoroughly educated in metallurgy. For the most part, the metallurgy I know is the stuff I need to know to make stuff. Like, I've never really gotten heavy into the chemistry of it. The chemistry I was studying was about rocks and minerals. It was not metal specific. I never have gotten too deep into that. Right. So then I went to college go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, you talked about how that was reflecting into your artwork, that type, the way those shapes move in the sphere. So what type, like, kind of give us an overview, if you can, about like what did the artwork, the sculpture that you were making, what did they kind of look like?
Right. So probably the easiest one to describe without images was I would start with a cube of steel. And these cubes would be anywhere from 1 inch up to 4 inch cubes. And I would slice them with a bandsaw, but I wouldn't slice them all the way through. And so I would slice, varying degrees through the cube on various angles, and then get the whole thing hot. And usually I would put it up on one corner underneath the power hammer or the press and squish it out, if that makes sense. I get like this fan effect. If you can imagine where I've put those slices, it wants to slide past itself. And so I made a bunch of, I remember at one point I bought a 12-foot-long bar of 3-inch square stock and sliced it up into cubes. Yeah. And then I bought a big old 4-inch square piece as well. And a lot of these I would end up squishing them out flat. Like, even the 3- and 4-inch cubes, I would squish them out until they were like a quarter inch thick. Then I would raise them, and I would make flowers sometimes, or bowls, or other three-dimensional objects, using that as my starting point. Another thing, I did a lot of twists.
Oh, that's great.
A lot of blacksmiths love to do twists. Mm-hmm. So I got into really studying how things deform when you twist them. So I would take bars and drill lots of holes in the sides of the bars, and drill the holes close enough to each other where one hole would influence the hole next to it and influence the hole next to it. And so they would deform together, and some of them would make, like hourglass shapes. Some of them, like the edge between the two holes, would break and it would make barbs. And then I would use those as elements in architectural or sculptural pieces.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, as you were explaining that, that's kind of what I started to imagine was the scoring into like twisting a square bar to get like an interesting pattern when you twist it.
Right.
And seeing how you would take that idea and turn that into an art form, where starting with a shape, cutting in different angles, and then just squishing it, see what it does, how it moves, how when you release the tension between areas of the steel cube, then it will make a shape. And I can imagine too that would be variable based off of how it was heated all the way through, you're not holding that cube of steel exactly the same way every single time. So you might get, like, even with the same cuts, you might get a variation of movement.
Oh, absolutely.
Shape. That's
absolutely
really interesting.
It's cool. Oh yeah. And you can do the same cuts and then just squish it on a different corner and see what happens, And I mean, you can go on and on,
And that's a huge advantage of starting so young, because I'm sure you made a bunch of either weird cuts or mistakes, and then it turned out to be something interesting, or you didn't even think about it until later on in life when you're starting to think more artistically, and you're like, oh, well, I remember I put these two holes too close together, and when I twisted, they broke it in a funny way, but you're like, that'd be perfect for the center of this flower or whatever. Like, it's such a great thing. You had such a backlog of experience.
Yeah, and, when you're young like that, you have this, and I mean, obviously people keep it with whatever they do later into life, but you have, at that age, you have so much wonder. Like, you're just like, I can't wait to see what it does, that whatever it does, you're excited, you know? And so, and you just keep going, because it's not about finishing it. It's about, you're really keyed up on the experience of doing it and seeing what happens. And I'm known for making mountains of scrap metal. I mean, that's just kind of like, you know, it doesn't bother me. Like, I really, I enjoy the process that much that it's really the doing of it that keeps me going.
That's great. Yeah, I love that. That's so important. And I think that's another one of the reasons why we've tried to keep the projects that we do on the channel so variable, so versatile, because of like, I want to have that excitement of doing something. It's the projects. It's the action of doing something that's exciting. And I don't want to get into the, you know, like where we're doing one type of thing over and over again, because that's the thing that everyone likes to see on the YouTube channel. You know, it's like, I like to keep it exciting for me by doing lots of different things. And, and it's all about that, right? It's about the, like, so many of the projects I do are, it's like the first time I've done something and I'm kind of experiencing it with other people. And then I'll go back to something that I've done before, and just those experiences of doing other things for the first time, it makes me excited about, you know, all of the projects. So I can definitely see that. So, so now we're like, you're in college, you're doing some of the artwork, and then you're like kind of moving through because you understand, okay, maybe I can do all this, in my own shop. You know, you're getting what you can out of it, but you're moving on. So then where are you going at that point? What are you doing with this, the new skills you have?
At one point I took a semester off from college and decided I was going to go to California and find a job as a blacksmith. And it worked out great. It really worked out. I found a really cool job where I just stepped into this shop at exactly the right time. The man who ran it was in his late 40s, and his shoulders had gone bad, and he really could hardly swing a hammer anymore. But he had a welder. He had a guy who would do all the welding. It was, you know, that was his thing. And then another guy who would do the finish work and that kind of thing. And so he needed somebody to do layout and forging. And I just, you know, I started doing it, and it worked out.
That's perfect.
It was really cool. And I loved it. And so I did that, and I wanted to stay, actually. But he convinced me to go back and finish college. So I did. And then I actually went, after I finished college, I went back and worked for him for another, I don't know, year or two. That was, you know, 1994 or five or whatever, and one big factor was that the economy in California tanked at that time, and people were no longer spending a lot of money on fancy metal architectural projects. But there were other factors with him and the shop and everything. And so, after a year or two, it was time for me to move on. And so I came back to Virginia and went back to work in the shop that I had always worked in, but the arrangement was very different. Where it was a good sized shop, and Lee was very generous in sharing it with me, and I worked for him as well as doing my own work for a while, and I got involved in doing other things as well. I tried to start this organic farming school with my family, which we got pretty far along with. You know, we were kind of ahead of the curve there, but that ended up kind of falling apart. But that was a very cool project. We restored all these old barns and a 150-year-old cabin and all that kind of thing. Then I got into other kinds of projects, and I kept coming back to the blacksmithing, that was possible because I kind of had an open invitation, to come back to it. So I would do other things. I would come back, got involved in doing, I was like a project manager on some construction jobs, and kind of got to the point where it was like, all right, like, it's time to either really jump into this or not. and it just wasn't for me. You know, I like my, that's just not my world. Right. So I, sorry, were you gonna say something? No.
Yeah, I was gonna say earlier, you mentioned that you got into organic farming with your family. Is that with your, like your brother's sister's parents, or is that your, son's family?
No, this was before them. This was, my sister was really the organic farmer. Okay. It was actually some great aunts of my dad's who had this old farm that had been in their family for over 100 years, and there were only two of them left. There were like eight siblings in the family, and only two of them, they all lived like into their 80s, 90s. There were these two sisters left, and they were in their 90s. And it started when I agreed to refurbish this old cabin, which was literally a tool shed, and just tore mm-hmm. it down to okay. down to the logs and added something on and made a little house out of it. And the idea was they wanted somebody living on the property who they knew and they could call on to. They were incredibly, just fiercely independent. Didn't want anybody in the house. You know, they wanted, even though they were in their 90s. You know, but they did want somebody on the property. And so the whole thing ended up morphing into this much larger project. And so I was not the farmer. My sister was the farmer. But I was, at that time, okay. I wanted to live there, and I wanted to turn one of those barns into a blacksmith shop. I mean, one of them had been a blacksmith shop, 100 years ago.
Cool.
And so I wanted to get that going again, but it's not worth getting into. But the whole thing ended up not happening. So I did live there for maybe a year or something, but we let all the fields lay fallow for I think a year, and we're trying, because they'd had cattle in there, and they'd sprayed all kinds of things, chemicals on it for quite some time, and it needed to kind of return to the earth for a while. So we were in that process when the whole thing ended. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, and that's interesting that you say that that was kind of in the beginning of that kind of the kind of green movement, I would say, right?
Right,
so organic farming and things. It's interesting that you like almost had that going, but that's cool. Yeah. I love all historic and vintage things, and just the history that's in an object. And so I can imagine the history that's in like this farm that was part of your family, and these buildings that have been there for so long, and just being able to spend some time in them and taking them apart and rebuilding them, and having this history there. It sounds really interesting to me. So
it was amazing. Cool. So there was one barn. It was probably 60 feet square, and We filled the whole thing up with all the stuff we found and cataloged it. I mean, it was like a museum of early 20th century technology. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah.
We grew up on a farm as well. That was in the family for a long time. And I mean, I was so young. Dustin was just a little bit older, but still, I remember going through the barns and just, like mystery, and you're constantly finding old things and interesting things, and getting lost. I mean, a big wide open farm is such a fun, exciting place to be, or at least I guess from our views growing up on the farm.
Yeah, I did not get to grow up on a farm. Yeah. I grew up on the side of a small mountain in the woods, so I had never really spent a lot of time on a farm, so it was really cool for me.
That's great.
A cabin in the woods is cool too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did your sister get into farming? How was that?
I don't really remember how she got into it originally. But she was very she still is very passionate about it. She's ended up doing quite a bit of that over the years.
Okay. It sounds like our brother Derek, he's definitely into as much organic and green stuff as he can eat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, so now we're moving on again. So I'm trying to like see where we were, 'cause I kind of pulled you back to the farm stuff, 'cause that was kind of interesting to me, 'cause we grew up on a farm. But, so after that, you decided to you kind of kept coming back to blacksmithing.
I did. I kept coming back to it. I would do all these other things, and they just, you know, as soon as I would see that hot metal, man, it just, it would suck me in. Like, I had to get back in there and be a part of that. You know, and that's another thing I did. I spent a year managing a small company where I would take anywhere from 3 to 15 guys way out into the mountains, and we would gather landscaping boulders and building stone. And I mean, some of these boulders would be, you know, the size of like a van. We had big rubber.
Holy cow! Geez.
We had big rubber tired loaders, and we're on the side of the mountain. It was insanity, it was kind of fun for a year. It was kind of fun for a year, but I definitely, after a year, I was ready to move on. And then it was actually shortly after that when I decided that I was really going to try to, you know, create my own shop and, you know, have my own thing going. So I basically started a shop in an industrial building went to work doing all the stuff, the kinds of stuff I'd always done, with a big mix of architectural commissions and production work, and just kind of kept doing that. And over, you know, so that was, you know, 23 years ago or something. Over that last 23 years, I've always kept the shop going. I've had, you know, times when it was just me, times when there was most of the time one person working for me, sometimes more, but it's never been like a big operation. That's not really what I want. But I have, during that time, I've also taken on, I've gotten into other things as well during that time, but I keep coming back to it, so.
That's great. So, in that amount of time, you said you like kind of doing some other things. That's kind of one of the things I was interested in, is you have, this like passion for blacksmithing, which you've always had. It's always like drawn you back in. And it seems like you have always kind of come at it in the perspective of doing it because you love doing it. And obviously it's all part of it. Some of the production stuff is part of it. Some of the, you know, like the architectural stuff is, and then the artistic stuff, that's all part of that passion. I was going to ask you, like, if this is something that you've done for a long time and now it's more of a business, then do you have like side hobbies? But it seems like you kind of answered that. You've said you've done kind of piecemealed back in other things all along the way, and then always kind of come back to blacksmithing.
Well, it's such physically demanding work, in terms of, you know, the repetitive motion stuff, and just the fact that you're actually moving pretty fast all day, but it also just all the stuff you breathe, like you can't really avoid it. So it's always it's always felt to me like, I know when it's time, and I just need to get away from it for a little while. And so that's been a big, big part of all that. And then, it has never for me become just a business. Like, if it became that, like, I could find much easier ways to make money. I can promise you that. It's just like, it's really hard. I mean, so, you know, the money part of it I've been fortunate that I have been able to have that perspective, it's also been, I guess, a bit of a discipline for me to, you know, just make sure that that's, you know, where my priorities are with it. It's just not, it's something that I, like, you know, anybody who really gets into it, it's like it's in your blood, and you just want to keep doing it, you know. It's not really it's about anything other than that. And I guess at the times when I felt like, you know, I was getting overworked by it, or, you know, I didn't have that feeling anymore. I guess I've been fortunate that I've been able to step away and do other things and rest up or whatever and come back to it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think that's important just as a way to get some perspective on the thing that you love, is right. to be able to, having that ability to step back, because I think so many people get into, like you said, if it, like you're in the business for it and it becomes just the job and it's repetitive, and then you're not excited to get into it again. And of course there's the reality of being adult and having to make money, and you know yep. that there's a job aspect to what we're doing, and sometimes you're not excited about going in and doing it, but you know, you got to do that. But then having that ability to step back a little bit, and just me as a fine artist as well as a craftsman, you know, because I do a lot of different things, when I go back to doing something, like when I get my paints out and I go back out to the landscape and paint for a couple hours, it's just so refreshing to be able to go back into that and then having had time away from it and really enjoying that, like yeah. that aspect, that experience again. So
right. I think you're right.
Yeah. yeah.
It's like throwing a frisbee. You don't want to do it all day, but you haven't done it for a while. It's good to really chuck one.
Right, absolutely. It is. Yeah, it really is.
So you've been doing it for so long, and then what made you want to switch over to doing cookware? Was it an idea of you wanted to do something that a lot of people could use, or was there a love in food?
No, it was this was 6 years ago or so, and I had taken a little break and gotten away from blacksmithing, and quite often, you know, when I get away from it and I decide I want to get back to it, like I know that all I have to do is just go in there and start doing something. And so mm-hmm. that's what I did. I went in and I started making something, and very quickly that spark came back, and I was not really sure what I wanted to do, but I was making some little sculptures and some little, I was actually making some trivets, actually, some, you know, for putting on a table, was the thing that I was mm-hmm. most interested yep. in. And this guy who was working upstairs, there's another metal shop upstairs from me, came down a couple times and was just, you know, adamant that he wanted to come in and start learning some blacksmithing. And so he came in and we started, we started making some of my old production pieces, using it as a tool to, you know, just teach. And one day he brought this magazine article in about carbon steel cookware, and I remember sitting down and reading that article, and as soon as I read it, I thought, I just got to do this. Like, it just, like the scale of it, you know, I mean, at this point I'm in my late 40s and I'm kind of done with big and heavy, you know, like that's, mm-hmm. that just yeah. doesn't work very well for me anymore. And so the scale of the skillets, I went through a thing where I got into jewelry about, I don't know, 10 years ago. I did that for 2 or 3 years, which was a great experience. I'm really glad I did it, but I want to work bigger than that. So the scale of the skillets was really kind of just right. And, reading that, you know, and in Europe and Asia, that's what all the good cooks have, a carbon steel skillet or wok in their kitchen, right? And just thinking right. about the trends in our country of people getting into cooking, and the possibilities of, with my background of playing around with all these ways of doing decorative things with pieces of metal, and how I could, use the idea of a skillet as sort of a blank canvas and go from there. Like it rang true for me. So I started working on it right away. Like I dropped what I was doing and just kind of went full bore. It was a big part of the attraction was the fact that the people use these things and handle these things so much. Yeah. You know, historically blacksmiths not only make almost all of their own tools, but they make the tools for most of the other craftsmen as well. There's right. it's different. Right. There's just something different, you know, when you hang something on a wall it's not the same as when you're handling it every day and you're doing something with it and you develop this, you know, relationship in space where you're feeling the thing regularly. And so that was something that I had never really found before. I mean, I made a lot of furniture, you know, which obviously people are sitting on it and eating on right. it and all, but it's not the same as a skillet where people are picking it up and washing it and their food is going into it. And they really do develop a relationship with it. That's just, you know, because of the constant use and the proximity, it's more intense than if it's hanging on the wall or whatever. And that really attracted me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah. So that was what got me going with it. And honestly, like, I've cooked an incredible volume of food with three athletic boys who are now in their 20s, but I'm not a great cook. Like, that's, I mean, I'm okay, but and I can certainly crank it out, but like, that was not really my big interest, was the cooking thing. I've become a much better cook since I, you know, started cooking with these skillets and thinking about it more. But that was originally, that was not really my big interest. Yeah.
Where do you get these? If you're not the cook, where do you get these beautiful who cooks your stuff for your Instagram and for all like your gallery? Like, yeah, it looks like very complicated, beautiful, good food.
Yeah. I mean, one of my sons is an excellent cook, and he's done quite a bit of that. And then, It's been, people are into it, you know, people volunteer, and I often, you know, will trade a skillet for somebody and they'll get all into it. And it's really hard. Like, food photography is difficult, and people get into the challenge of it.
Yeah.
Right. So I have lots of customers that send me good photographs. And so it's been,
that's awesome.
I don't know how many different people have taken all those photographs. It's been a lot.
Nice. That's great. Yeah. And that was, as you were talking about, just the idea of making something that then someone has a relationship with. I think that is one of the things that really has like fueled my desire to do more craft work than the fine art work. That was my background that I went to school for. I still love that work, but like, once you're finished that piece, it's just sitting there. Someone can enjoy it visually, but there's something different about building a relationship with this object or this thing where, you know, if I make a knife for somebody or if I make something else that they're handling and holding and using, they become familiar with, okay, this is the way I like to do it, or this is this part right here. If I hold it this way, I can do this thing with it. And you build that relationship over time. I think that's something that's really important about craft, is that you are creating the beginning of an experience for someone else.
Absolutely. And
that's something that keeps bringing me back to it.
Right. And the knife analogy is a particularly good one, because just like knives, the handmade pans actually cook better than the ones that are stamped out. They're made out of thicker steel. Like, nobody is stamping out carbon steel pans out of thicker steel. You just, like, the stamped out ones, they warp and they don't spread the heat out as evenly as the handmade ones. And, you know, just like with a knife, like, the handmade knives tend to hold an edge better, right? It's interesting that way. Those two things kind of go hand in hand that way.
So, right. I mean, they're all, like, they're gorgeous. All the cookware you make is cool, really nice. What was the process like trying to get it right, trying to find the right thickness? Like, did you have someone, like your son or whoever, like, hey, try this out? Or was there a, like, kind of a guidebook that you went with to, like, hey, this is normally what the European skillets have?
Oh, no, it was absolute trial and error. And fortunately, Jack, the guy who brought the magazine article in, who was there for the whole process of developing the pans and the tooling and all of that, he is a serious foodie. And so he would take them and cook with them, but he also had a good friend who is a, you know, kind of well-known chef, and we would take them to him. Right. And he loved them, and we got lots of great feedback from him. And so there were a few very good cooks involved, but like after a few iterations, like I could take one home and put it on the stove and, you know, tell how it was doing. Like they educated me, you know, about what it needed to do. And it's, you know, you can start to tell just by how the food sears, you know, there's this certain quality of the sear that you get with carbon steel skillets. And you can just, once you start to do it, once you've done it a few times, you start to get a feel for it. It's not that complicated, you know.
What do you think the advantages over a cast iron skillet, like doing carbon steel? Is it like maybe some of a lightness to, you know, a workability with it?
Right. So the weight is one reason that people often prefer carbon steel. And, you know, because the carbon steel, the forged steel is so much stronger, not only can we make them lighter, but we can also do these decorative things with them. And so, you know, that's important to a lot of people, just the way it looks. But it also allows us to put these much, much longer handles on them. So, you know, like our skillets, because of the way that we split the handle and we make it long, the handle doesn't get hot on the stovetop. Like cast iron skillets have that very short handle, because if it were any longer, it would break off. I mean, they break off anyway.
Right.
But with these, we can make them long enough that you can still use the handle without it getting hot. The single biggest reason is the conductivity. The forged metal conducts much better than cast iron. So that just gives you much finer control of the heat. So if you turn it up or down a little bit, the pan responds much faster. And so that's what you want when you're searing and browning. That's when that really matters, is when you're trying to get just that right amount of crispiness on the outside of the food without drying it out on the inside. And so, you know, that's for people who cook that way, these skillets make a huge difference. If somebody, you know, does not do very much searing or browning, they just kind of scratch their head. They just don't really see much of a difference in their cooking. That is the single biggest reason is the conductivity of the carbon steel.
Right, that kind of the sensitivity of the heat and control on the steel. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So I was kind of looking back through some of your pictures in your gallery and your website, and a little bit further back you had some really kind of beautiful patterning around the outside edges and the lip of the different pans. How are you making that? I was kind of looking at it, and it's a pretty consistent pattern. How's that happening? Is that just tooling under the power hammer and being like careful about where it's placed, or how does that work?
I'm interested. No, it's this thing that I've been doing for 25 years where I take two plates of steel and put something in between them. In this case, little round bars that I take, it's 1/8-inch round that we bend into a V and then curve the sides of the V. And so, you know, like on a medium skillet, there will be 45 of these little bars all the way around the outside of that thing. And then we actually MIG weld each one to around the edge of a circle of steel. And then we weld another circle of steel on top of that. And so I made all these jigs for that whole process. We got it where the only reason it makes any sense is because we're making two at once. If that weren't the case, then forget. Gotcha. You know, that kind of like gets us over the line. And so we take that, we call it, so once we have the two plates of steel together with the two bars, the 45 little bars around the side all welded together, we get the whole thing hot and we forge it. And so we're squishing the sandwich where, and the plates deform around the bars. The bars deform as well. They squish out. They become very flat. And they're actually, they're really beautiful. I make jewelry out of those sometimes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then it's pretty labor. I mean, it's extraordinarily labor intensive. I mean, it's hot and, you know, it takes, you know, four or five heats to forge that thing down, of just going as hard as we can with the power hammer. And with the large skillets, we actually have, and the woks, we have two people holding it under the power hammer. It's just too much for one person. And so we have the whole sandwich forged down. And so we avoid forging in the middle. So, you know, you want a nice heavy base.
Right.
And so that was kind of the whole idea. The original idea behind that was, this way you can have this extra heavy, thick base, which is what you really want. But the whole pan is much lighter because the walls are forged way down. And so if the whole pan on those pans, on the artisan line, if the whole pan were that thick, it would be heavier than any cast iron skillet you ever picked up. I mean, it's that much of a difference.
Right,
it's that much of a difference. Like, we really forge it down. And so, once we have the sandwich all forged down, we, let it cool and then cut the edges of the circle off where all the welds are. Just, I made like a turntable and a little holder for my plasma cutter. And so we just slide it in there, turn the plasma cutter on, and spin the thing around, and it cuts the whole edge off. And they just fall apart at that point. And so now we have the two blanks, which we can make the skillets out of. Does that make sense?
Right. So you're just tack welding the top of the V, the top of the curved V on the very edge, and you just cut that all the way around.
Exactly.
Cut that edge off.
Yes. Right. And there are videos out there.
Oh, man, that's fascinating.
Right. We have videos somewhere of all of that. I can't tell you exactly where they've been posted, but they're out there.
That's great. Oh, man, that's what a cool process. And I was thinking as you're explaining it, in my mind, I'm imagining you're, you know, forging the whole thing. But then as you start to get, okay, you're working around the outside, then it makes sense, right? Because you're thinning out that outside edge, which then becomes the lip and the sides. And, you know, that's so cool.
Was there a point in time where you, went too far with not like a certain decorative element? Like, I see the majority of the pictures are very clean, beautiful skillets with a really cool handle, but it's very simple and clean and really nice. Did you ever go too far with decoration and go like, well, that's time and cost prohibited. Like we can't,
we can't
do all of these like this.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I do, man. Like I've always got more ideas that I need to try out. And I mean, I made an incredible amount of scrap metal and working on the pans. But, you know, that's what I'm into. I enjoy that. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. That's great. So when did, you say that it's you and your sons that are doing it. When did they get into it? Was it something that they just did? They saw their dad doing all these years and got into it.
Right. So none of my sons are working anymore for me anymore. They've moved on to other things, which is, they're all in their mid-20s now. And if you're not, you know, totally driven to do this kind of work, then forget it. Like, you should be doing something else. So one of my sons, Eli, was very interested when he was young. And I mean, from the age of, you know, 3 or 4, he was in the shop making stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, by the time he was 6 or 7, he was, you know, like really working with hot metal and all of that. And he doesn't even know how good the talent that he has, like, because he hasn't worked in other shops. Like, the only person he's ever worked with is me, and he has no idea of the talent that he has. It's extraordinary. And he and I developed this incredible relationship at the shop. I'll never forget there was a day, he was probably 12 years old, and we were in the shop making stuff, and all of a sudden I realized we were both forging on the same anvil, which is ridiculous. You just don't do that.
Oh, wow.
And like it was, it felt it, like it was so comfortable. Like we just, like we were that much in, you know, this connection of what the other one was doing, and like it was no problem at all. And we kept doing it, you know, for like an afternoon. And like I thought, like I would never do that with anybody. So Eli has had that sort of
just
awareness in the blacksmith shop from a very early age, and it's like it comes easily to him. Like I've never had anybody else work for me who has just gotten that comfortable with it. He's extraordinary. That was very cool. And then his brother Sam, he would come in and do stuff when he was young. Like when he was a teenager, you know, he's really into lacrosse, and we made a goal, and actually he made a goal.
Cool.
I just helped him. And I mean, we would do those kinds of things. And like, you know, when they were all like 6 or 7 and they were all into knights and stuff, we made swords and shields and all that. All three of them were doing it. But at an early age, Eli was the only one that really got into it. But then, Sam got into making the skillets when that came along, Sam's just got this incredible spatial awareness. Like he just, like when you're walking down a street with him, he's one of those people who's like noticing the architectural elements on the sides of the buildings and asking questions, and he always has been. So like he was right at home with it. I learned with both of those guys, like I would teach them how to do something and get them going and walk away, come back an hour later. And most of the time I would learn something at that point. It was like, man, I never thought of doing that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, they really do have a certain aptitude for it. So that was very cool. And interestingly, their other brother, Gus, who is a mechanical engineer, never really got into it much, but he's actually a mechanical. He's a mechanical engineer in a fire brick factory now. Go figure. And he would come in and work some, and you know, but it just it never really turned his crank as much. I don't know. It's kind of funny. But it was a really great thing for us over COVID. Two of them were in college and came home and they weren't real happy taking their classes online and stuff. And it really gave us a focus. Honestly, it like at one point, you know, I would have one of them taking care of the website and all the marketing stuff. And they're very good at it. You know, young people just on the computer are a different animal.
Yeah.
And so that was great. And then, you know, all four of us were, working on it, and it was a really cool thing for us to do over COVID. And then after that, they each made their own decision. They have other things they want to do, and I cannot fault them for that in the least. And I strongly encouraged them to do other things. You know, when young guys come in and say they want to work for me, like I've learned, like, really the best thing to do is discourage them a few times. And if they keep coming back, those are the ones that, all right, let's do it. And then, you know, that they're the ones who will actually just have the perseverance. I mean, it's a very slow craft, and it's very, you know, learning it is very slow. So if it's not just burning inside of you, then you should be doing something else.
Yeah, that's something that like our parents. So we have there are four of us, four brothers, and our parents have always been very supportive of like anything that we wanted to do. You know, like, but then also just being there, being caring and loving and supportive and
right.
You know, so that's a huge benefit to a young person's confidence and mind that right. you have support from your parents. Like as an artist, someone who went to art school, I paid a lot of money to go to college for art. My parents were always supportive of that. They were always, right. if this is what you do, if this is what you're passionate about, let's do it. Like, they didn't have a ton of money, so they couldn't pay for me. You know, they were able to help right. support me while I was there, and then they understood that this is, you know, and I understood that it was something I was taking on, but I had so many peers and so many friends who didn't have that support, who didn't have someone saying, like, I believe in what you believe in. I believe that you want to do something you're passionate about and you want to go forward through it. And, you know, and they were just, is it going to make you money? Is it going to, you know, is it going to pay the bills? What's your job after college? And a lot of that's really important. It's important to have some of that aspect, but it's also important just to have someone who's supportive of understanding that life is about, you know, being passionate and enjoying what you're doing. It's so short, and, you know, making great connections, making great friends, having a great experience, and then being able to do that and support yourself and support your family, all in a balance. You know, yeah, it can't right. ever be just yeah. one thing or the other thing. You right. got to be able to figure out a way to balance
and
it.
It's not so. Easy. Like, whatever you do, you know, it's, you right. need that, you need that right. support, you know, you need, you really
when,
do.
When, for yeah. sure. When you, so, the pandemic, I mean, a lot of people did get more into the hobby of cooking. And I mean, that's all a lot of right. people could do is like, well, stay at home and learn to cook right. or learn to bake. Did business pick up at all or how was absolutely. It? I mean,
yes, absolutely.
It yeah.
was, yeah. And it, before the pandemic, I was taking these things into mostly high-end craft shows was how I was selling them. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really gotten the website sales going. And then, you know, it was kind of perfect for me because I would much rather ship a bunch of skillets than haul them to a show and do all of that. So,
yeah, you don't want to come up to Baltimore unless you have to.
Exactly. yeah. So it really, you know, when the pandemic hit, I, you know, got the website in much better shape, and Eli was and Gus were, you know, built this new website, and oddly, it was still early in the pandemic, and Eli built the website, and the day we were going to launch it, this guy called me up and said, "Man, I've been looking at your pans. I'm an analytics guy. I'm looking to trade some work for some skillets." And I said, "Well, you know, I need help with marketing. We're about to launch this website, and you could, you know, jump in and become a part of this." And he did. And he and Eli worked together, and we started selling a lot more skillets online than we had ever sold at shows. So it worked out really, really well. You know, it was very cool.
That's great. Well, yeah, serendipity. That's perfect right. timing.
Yeah,
that's
it really
great.
Was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, shows, I feel like shows are so tough, especially the more and more modern. Well, the way the world changes, people barely want to talk to anyone on the phone. So I feel like at a show, a lot of people, they don't want to interact and chat, and they'll just kind
of
like cruise by and look.
There
it's
is a
so
lot
much
of that.
Better if you can get some type of. So if, it's so much better if you can get it like a. Obviously an online presence and go through that and social media. And it just spreads like wildfire to where all of a sudden you got way more, work than
it
you
does.
Maybe and, want or like, you're like, okay, here we go.
Right. And the carbon steel thing is a niche, and what I'm doing is a niche within that niche. So, I mean, you know, like at a show, 100 people walk by and for whatever reason, like, two of them are just absolutely, you know, turned on by these pans. So it's a numbers thing, you know. The same thing applies on the internet. You're just getting a whole lot more eyeballs, you know. That's the deal. So.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then, I mean, the nice thing about a social media platform like Instagram or any of them is that it becomes more searchable, right? So you can search for specific things. So you have people who are interested. You may get the kind of the passerby in your analytics who found it because of someone else who said something and they just happened to like something that was similar. But with Instagram, you know, I can search cast iron skillets if it's something I'm interested in, then it'll give me tons of people who are doing that, or, you know, in the grand scheme of things, way more than I would have ever seen at you know, half a dozen shows or just in my everyday day-to-day life. You know, it's, I might never see that thing. And that's one of those things that I think is really nice about the community of social media. There's a lot of things I don't like about social media, but the community aspect of it, where we can connect with people, like the fact that you and I were able to connect and, you know, and now have you on the podcast. That's a really nice aspect of social media, that it's kind of puts people who with like interests together.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We talk about that. Well, when we went to Maker Camp and certain things where we meet up with a lot of other people who make it's a positive social media group, because everyone kind of appreciates in this group of people, we appreciate hard work. We appreciate craft and art and beauty. And a lot of those things, that is definitely a good group to be in. It's not, I don't find that it's toxic at all.
I agree, and I think that's one of those important points, because there, like I said, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of negativity within social media and within this, like, this arena where you can say something and do something and there's there's no face-to-face interaction, there's no kickback, because you just turn off your computer and walk away, you know? So, but there is a lot of positivity in the kind of, in the maker community and the just kind of people supporting people and, you know, shouting people out and just a lot of, you know, collaborations and things. It's just, it's a really cool aspect to social media that I never knew until we started the channel. Because I'd done Facebook, and there were a few groups, like I've always loved axes, so I've been part of the Axe Junkies community group on Facebook for a long time, and that was kind of fun. But I like the Instagram community. You can kind of connect with a more specific group of people, and find interests and find people, and there's a lot of growth and a lot of community built in that, and has really pushed our, you know, our channel and the you know, the people we know. It's
great. I like your YouTube videos where you answer the trolls' comments and questions. That's really cool. And you know, you get to pick and choose which ones you want to answer, and it's very educational. You know, it's cool.
Yeah, that's one of those things we thought of. There's a lot of questions just over the years that have come through, a lot of the same questions where people are asking things, and so there have been multiple times we thought about, okay, well, maybe let's do a video on one of these questions that keeps getting asked over and over again, because it's obviously something that I either didn't hit on well enough, or it's just something that's interesting to enough people. I didn't realize at the time. So then we were like, Devin was like, well, let's do some questions videos where we kind of bring back up those questions that we heard a lot over the years and answer them and try to get a little specific without getting too crazy and deep into it. So,
right.
Yeah.
And a lot of those questions that you think are, like, I think you told me, Dust, you're like, I don't know. Like, do people want to hear from me about this random stuff? It's like, yeah, maybe or maybe not, but it's the questions you think are stupid or simple are not stupid and simple for 90% of the people watching or following social media. So it's like these basic things that you go, yeah, like do this or...
Right, it's true. Yeah.
Or like you were saying, Yates, like grind with your feet and your, like, from the lower body thing. All these things that seem simple and obvious because you've done it so long, it might be interesting to other people. And then then we throw on the mediumly angry troll comments just for fun, because it's just fun to answer them.
Yeah, that has been fun. And it's, we, you know, like, and same thing with analytics and trying to follow the numbers and stuff. We're like, okay, well, what types of things get you know, get good views as well. It's the sensational stuff that gets good views, but we don't want to really fall into that category. So we're like, how can we play it a little bit? You know, like how do we play that up? And one of the things that Devin said is that, you know, a lot of times you'll get these clickbaity titles in YouTube videos, and then they won't really address what they've talked about in the title until very later on in the video, you know, and you're like, I want to know right away why, you know, what is the greatest, you know, gun shot ever made in history, you know, like, and they don't get to it. So Devin was like, well, for the trolley videos, let's do the title, kind of that clickbaity title, and then we'll get into that trolley comment. Yeah,
like write down. Dustin walks in, sits down, answers the question. If you want to hang around some more, then fine. But like, if all you really wanted to hear was the weird troll question, like, we'll do that right off the bat. And then if you want to hang around for the rest of the stuff and show and tell, like, yeah, that's right. Cool too.
Yeah. It's well done. I like it.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been fun. It's one of the things that we were trying to find some other videos to kind of mix in, because our longer projects just take longer, you know? So it's like, well, we could wait 3 or 4 weeks in between videos, or we can do some of these question videos and kind of sprinkle them in here and there as well. Mm-hmm. Helps us do some smaller stuff that we can fit in there.
Have you thought, Yates, about doing a YouTube channel something like that? Or is it just too much?
We've talked about it, and we actually we shot a bunch of video last week, and we're putting a bunch of clips out somewhere. Okay. We may have already put some out. I don't know. It's better if somebody else does that. Let's just put it that way. That takes care of all that. We haven't. You know, done a whole lot of, you know, the kind of detailed recipes sort of, or, you know, really explaining a project the way that you guys do. Yeah, we haven't really done that. I've thought about it.
I think that's the thing. Yeah, you don't want to take away from, you can't spend all day on doing videos and editing. It's a lot of work, obviously. That's why Dustin and I split it up. But if you can get someone, there's such a lack of professional craftsmen like yourself. People have done it for a long time. There's a lot of people who have done a little bit of this and that, like Dustin, kind of done a little bit of everything, and we'll just show it. But if I feel like there's such, anytime I see someone who's done it for so long and are pros, it's like, oh man, if you could get on there, you would really show people how it's done and really lay on some facts and info on people that people would love.
I've thought about doing that.
I think one of the things that we talk about, especially more recently on this podcast, is the mystique and the beauty of like Asian culture when they're working on things. And I think that goes back to kind of where we started. You were saying Yates is like, it's all part of the art, right? It's each part of the thing is in the moment when you're creating something as a craftsman, it's all there. And you really see that when I'll look at a documentary of, you know, some type of Japanese craftsman who's doing something, and you can just tell that each part of it is as important as every other part. Right. You know, like just the process of getting up in the morning and starting the fire, and then, you know, getting out your tools and materials and cleaning them, and then getting ready, and all the process, all the setup, it all seems just as important as then working through the whole thing and then the final piece. Like there's nothing that's rushed or pushed aside or done as secondary. It's each thing is part of the art in the moment. You know, maybe that's kind of that Zen concept and something that it's kind of always naturally been interesting to me. So maybe that's that's the thing. Maybe that's what you're looking for, Devin, in the like in the video, is that the level of ability, a level of skill that is maybe missing in some things in YouTube. You don't see it as much where you have people who have a really high craft ability than showing what they're doing. So even if it were just like you saying, you guys are doing some videos of what you're doing, Yates, and putting those up on YouTube, you know, just showing that, if nothing else, that definitely can't hurt your business at all, right? You know, like when people can see that and they feel the story of what you're doing, as well as then seeing that final product.
Right. I really enjoyed your video of the rock stacking. You did that. Like, there's that long period where Devin is just trying to feel that rock that's sitting there, and then Abe somehow.
Yeah, Dustin.
Derek.
I'm sorry, Derek.
And he's just trying to feel that rock.
We get that all the time.
Yeah, and it goes on, and then somehow, like, just all of a sudden, the rock is balancing. Right, that was beautiful. It was very cool.
Yeah. We my brothers really enjoyed that for a long time, and it was really interesting to see the cycle, because it was something that I actually kind of introduced to him without trying to, by showing him the work of Andy Goldsworthy.
Right.
And it's really, like, inspired him over the years. It was really cool, so it was fun to be able to do that video. Yeah. All right, so I wanted to, so we're getting to the point, it's getting a little bit further on in the podcast, and I want to ask you to tell us a disaster story. So we've kind of heard your story from where you started, you got inspiration, all these different things you've done over the years. So I'm assuming you have all sorts of fun, stories about things that didn't work out. Obviously, you said you love making scrap metal. So
scrap metal
that's,
pile.
That's, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that really
so
is kind
of
my
So we love to
specialty.
Ask our guests. Yeah.
Right. So honestly, I mean, it's almost, sometimes it seems like any blacksmithing project that's worth doing has a disaster story. I mean, that's just kind of the nature of it, right? Yeah. I mean, it really is kind of like that.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, the skillets go, probably the biggest disaster story, or definitely the biggest disaster story, is the handles. When I started making the handles, like, I had a pretty good idea of, you know, I mean, I knew I wanted it to feel good in the hand, right? And the basic shape that I ended up arriving at was the one that I knew was probably going to feel the best. I liked the gracefulness of it. And so I spent, I don't know, maybe a week, maybe even 2 weeks, kind of, you know, making that handle using traditional blacksmithing techniques and refining it, you know, and getting all of the thicknesses down to where the thing looked right and felt right. And then finally, after a week or two or whatever, I made one. I was like, that's it. I made the right handle for that pan. And I just knew it. And then I proceeded to do this thing, which, I mean, blacksmiths talk about it. Like I'd been doing this work for 35 years or whatever at this point, and I tried to idiot-proof it, which you just can't do. Like, we all know it. And I literally spent over a month, maybe 6 weeks, trying to figure out all these ways to make this handle without having to really, you know, be present and do it as a blacksmith. And I mean, it was, in hindsight, it was absolutely comical. I literally, that's all I did for over a month, was try to find ways to make it easy. And it never, like, finally, I gave up. And I totally filled up my scrap bin. I went through all these different, you know, tools. I made a bunch of tools. I made a bunch of jigs. I did all kinds of stuff. And I arrived back at just using eyeballs, which, of course, is the way, you know, obviously is the way. That's what makes it look like, you know, something that's alive and something that a person made. I knew better. That's why it was such a disaster. I did learn a lot from it in terms of specifics of, you know, some of these tools I made and some of the processes that I was tinkering with. But I knew better at that point, you know. So that's my disaster story.
That's fascinating, because I think that's maybe the first time that I've heard someone talk about the pitfalls that you can run into when you're trying to make something really efficient. You lose some of that. You lose being in the moment. You lose some of what made it originally what was exciting. You know, it's like the blacksmithing, the hands-on aspect of that. And I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, you come up with a process and you come up with efficiencies for that process to make it work as best as possible and smoothly as possible and repeatable. When you're doing something like you're doing, you want to be able to repeat that thing over and over. You've put a ton of time into making it just right. So then how do you repeat that? But then you're taking, that's fascinating. Then you're taking away that personal, you know, experience of putting into it, of what you're putting into it and what you've, the time and effort.
Right. And you're also,
you know, that's what a, yeah, go ahead.
Well, you're also robbing yourself of the experience of continuing to refine that process. Right. Like I still learn things from making those handles, you know, I mean, I'm still getting better at it. And when you try to make the whole thing very rigid and very repeatable in a way where it can't be messed up, you're losing actually the opportunity to learn from the process. There's no doubt.
Right. Yeah, you've disconnected yourself from the activity of making it. You're just like, you've turned it into just the process, or you turn it into a machine that does it for you.
Right.
And there's obviously, there's important aspects to that. And like you said, there was a lot of things you learned along the way. And I'm sure there's tooling that you made that you consistently now use when you're doing it. So there are aspects of it. But yeah, I like when you started that story, you're saying this is something that blacksmiths always do. And I was like, I was excited. Like, what do they always do? What do they do that's wrong? It's like trying to take the hand away from it. That's what is it going to be?
Yeah. That's funny.
That's funny.
But yeah, right. If you get too far, too automated and too like, there's a jig for this and wrap this around and anyone could do this. And then, you know, people are wondering why, like, all right, why shouldn't I just go to Walmart and get the whatever, blah, 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 for $30? They're willing to pay what it should be, a high price for something that they know is handmade and the creator is present and you're getting a piece of art and something that will last a lifetime. So that's you know, that you're like, hey, this is what I'm offering, something special.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's having that knowledge that someone has made this thing and they've also looked it over and they made sure that it's as high quality as they're saying it is when they're giving it to you. You know, you're not getting something that's the half quality, right? Because you've put your time and effort into it. And when you make mistakes, those ones don't get sold. They get tossed in the scrap pile.
Right. So,
Right. Cool. All right. Do you have a recommendation for our listeners, Yates?
Well, the thing that is really on my mind these days that I like to share with people is the notion of dynamic stillness, it's a word that essentially represents a meditative state, and it's what osteopaths and craniosacral therapists use, and one of the things that is so beneficial as well as fascinating about it is that if somebody is able to enter this state, they can share it with others. And that's what osteopaths and craniosacral therapists do. It's really fascinating to me. So I would encourage people to check out Dynamic Stillness.
Any specific like book or website or something that you would recommend, or just have them just search for that in general?
You can search for it in general. There are a lot of different perspectives and you know, it's something that has evolved over time and is also, it's, you know, it's talked about using different words and many other contexts, but the website that I would recommend is dynamicstillness.com, which is, you know, just one of those. But I think it's very that is the website of a man named Charles Ridley, who I think really knows what he's talking about.
Awesome. That's great.
So cool. Just to get into that a little bit, you say it can connect you to others. How do you mean?
Right. So it's a meditative state, and in which you, I mean, you can feel it, and you can, if you are in that state, and I mean, really through the power of intention, but particularly if you, you know, touch somebody or hold somebody, you know, like, I mean, that's what osteopaths and craniosacral therapists do. They put their hands on you and they go into the state. Mm-hmm. And they call it the laws of entrainment. And it just, like, if the person is receptive, I mean, it's not really something you can force on anybody. It's definitely requires, mm-hmm. you know, a certain amount of relaxation as well as receptivity. If you're open to that, you start to enter that state as well. And at that point, the idea is you just relax into it. It's something that feels good and invites you to relax into it. And if you know what's going on and you're, you know, in an environment that you trust and you trust the person and you can relax into it, you will probably relax more deeply than you have in a long time.
And does this influence your creativity and your state of mind for making?
Oh, absolutely. It influences every aspect of your being.
That's great. Yeah, and obviously people who use their bodies for craft or for their job or for their life, you know, I'm sure and we're always looking for something to ease the pains, ease the soreness and the stiffness and the movement. And, you know, especially like with such a active dynamic movement with blacksmithing, I'm sure there's like, you know, this seems like something that would work perfectly with that.
Yeah, I think so.
And now I could see maybe why I can see why you like the rock bouncing, because you sound like our brother Derek. He's always like one with the rock, steady, ground yourself. Right. He's very intuitive that way. So it's there you go. It's right up your alley. That's awesome. That's cool. That is the first state of being recommendation we've ever had. So right on.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, it's great. All right, Dev, you have a recommendation?
I'm going to follow that. I'm going to cheat like I normally do, but I'm not going to recommend the same thing I've recommended over and over again.
Okay.
Like the last couple weeks, but I will cheat and say, really, if you haven't read Kitchen Confidential, read that. Anthony Bourdain's first book. It's funny and interesting. And I mean, if you've ever watched his shows, he's such a great writer. And also he's the reason why I never order well done steak, like, you know, since I was a young man, since I read the book, because he just says, like, you're a fool because they're just giving you whatever crap is left over, whatever is about to spoil. It doesn't matter because you won't tell, because I'm going to cook it well done. So I thank him for that.
Yeah, I never heard that.
Nice.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, well, yeah, it's right at the end of the month. We got the steak left over. Some people want it well done. So if we're going to cook the crap out of it, you know, whatever, just give them whatever's left. If you want something medium or rare, they're going to have to give you something of, you know, whatever's quality in the freezer.
Yeah, 'cause you're tasting that. Yeah. Right. It works perfectly with the skillets, right? That sear on the outside.
Yes.
Holds all the juices in.
Yep.
All right, my recommendation this week is Dustin Small, a namesake of mine. Mm. And that's Small Bar Smithy on Instagram. He's a blacksmith in Saskatchewan, Canada. Someone that I've found through, I think, through the Ford Side Chat, which is another podcast that I listen to occasionally that's blacksmithing centered. He just makes some really beautiful tools, really beautiful hammers. The reason why I'm recommending him is, other than the fact that we have a blacksmith on and I'm recommending another blacksmith, but the way he decides for his shapes of his tools, his shapes of his hammers and things, they're just a little different than other ones I've seen. They break the mold a little bit. He uses some interesting combinations of steels, and then also just the subtle shapes and chamfers and head sizes and things that he does is just a little bit different than some other ones that I've seen. And whenever I see him post something or he puts up some of his work or a tool, it always like captivates me that he kind of finds some of these other shapes. Now, he also uses some really traditional shapes as well on hammerheads or the tools that he makes, but it just looks like it takes a little bit of a different angle sometimes, which I think is just interesting and something that I think of when I'm making things is like, how can I do it in a way that relates to my own aesthetic, but also relates to history and a combination of those two things. So again, that's Dustin Small and Small Bar Smithy on Instagram.
Cool.
All right. Well, Yates, it was a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thanks. You. I appreciate it a lot.
I hope you, yeah, absolutely. And your story was as fascinating as I hoped it would be. It's great to hear all the everything you've been through and the, you know, the way you've like involved different people in your life and your family. And that's really important to us as well. And I think, you know, that's that not everyone has that in their life. And so it's really special to have that and to hear someone else talk about it. And we have a great relationship with our parents and still we all live in the Baltimore area and see each other pretty often. And we have worked together on different things over the years. And obviously Devin and I work together on the podcast and the YouTube channel. So
right. Cool.
It's nice to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Athena Skillets. Anyone who wants to check it out, you can go to athenaskillets.com and, or his Instagram. Gorgeous stuff, beautiful stuff. Yeah, so we'll have to come down to Lexington sometime and go to some restaurant that uses your pans, and we'll eat, drink, and be happy.
We'll do it.
Yeah. Where else can we? Yeah, right on. Where else can we find you? What's your Instagram handle and whatever else?
I honestly don't remember all that stuff, and I don't have it in front of me.
That's fine.
but basically, on any of those things, Athena Skillets is pretty easy to find. I think on Instagram, was Athena? Yeah. I can't remember. I'm not going to say because I can't remember.
Athena
underscore.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now I pulled it up. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll make sure we put all that in the show notes. People can find you and check
Thank
out
you.
The beautiful work.
Thanks.
And I'll send some people there and hopefully they'll buy some stuff and
great.
And support you. Then you can keep on making and keep on, enjoying the craft.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I appreciate what you guys do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you very much. All right. And everybody else, thank you guys. Make sure you don't forget to head over to YouTube and check out the work that we're putting up there. We're working on the new project, the Chopper Challenge Project, which is the Gunstock War Club. That's been kind of fun. It's not up there yet, but it'll be up there soon. Also, if you're listening to this on Friday, my plan is to do a live stream on Friday if I have the time after I get home from work. So
if you're
hearing this, pop in sometime in the afternoon, probably around 5:30 or so. I'm trying to do a live stream in the shop tomorrow, which is today if you're listening to it on Friday.
That was the curse of us. Like, hey, we're going to do this chopper challenge at knife real early. And now we're struggling. Well, we're not struggling. We've been so busy to get that done, but that's not going to be out for a while. So we're trying to fill in. We're going to do some lives. We're going to do some more question videos, and some smaller stuff, but we're still creating stuff. It's just, we're trying to prepare better for this new one.
But
we're going to put some stuff out before that.
Yep. And you can head over to Instagram and follow both Devin and I at The Art of Craftsmanship and at The Art of Camera Guy. You can follow Yates at Athena_Skillets. And if you guys want to support us further, you can head over to patreon.com and support us there. And all that support at Patreon goes right back into the channel. And then also, if you're there, you can be part of our Discord. You get a little, behind the scenes talking and chatting and more personal setting there, which is really interesting, as well as just the other benefits. And all that stuff goes back into the channel. So if you are supporting us there, thank you so much. We really appreciate all of that. And on that note, Yates, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Devin, always a pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah.
And everybody else, thank you guys for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELDWIN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELDWIN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.